Whether you're one of the world's finest mathematicians creating equations from scratch while fighting systemic racism at the same time, or you're just an idiot like me who probably would have stopped what I was doing to look at the sky to see if I could catch a glimpse of a capsule the size of a car entering the atmosphere thousands of miles away from me. Either way, you deserve good coffee. So join the rest of us in the future and switch to Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug has some of the greatest minds in coffee distribution working on ways to improve your personal experience. They start with premium Arabica beans that are always ethically sourced, fair trade. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, but what really sets Sparkplug apart is that they roast their beans right before they deliver them to you so that you're always getting the freshest possible coffee and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug a la carte, or you can join the Autopilot Coffee Club. It's customizable and flexible. All the convenience, none of the commitment. Use the promo code TOP100PROJECT, all one word, for a 20% discount. The future of coffee is here. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
We're already there. At least I'm already there.
The future is now.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hello, movie monkeys and NASA nerds, and thank you for riding the 379th rocket known as the Ellis's Analysis. We look at aged films and we spoil the dickens out of them. We started talking about movies nearly 8 years ago when we cataloged all 123 of AFI's selections for their 1998 and 2007 top 100 lists. All those are back years ago in that archive. I'm the guy who was on the math team in grade school, but who keeps proving in recent podcasts how bad he is at the subject now, Ryan Ellis. And here's the lady who does her best work while standing on a ladder or squatting on a toilet, my wife, Bev.
That's me.
You and Katherine Johnson. It's one of the better touches when she does the bathroom montage that she's always working in the washroom. It's not like she's saying, I gotta run halfway across the campus to go pee. That's true, but she also is taking the work with her.
Two things, though. She could actually walk and work rather than run and spend the 15 seconds that she's sitting on the toilet doing equations. And regardless of whether she wanted to work and walk at the same time or if she only worked while she was sitting on the toilet, she didn't need to take every single notebook with her. She could probably just get away with taking one.
Yeah, because you're not going to be in there for hours, although maybe this lady has just got a blockage problem.
It's all of that racist coffee. That's what you get when you drink chock full of nuts.
Okay, the coming attractions opinion question for Hidden Figures. What's the best movie about mathletes? Good Will Hunting is a good option. A Beautiful Mind. Not a good option for you, but The Imitation Game is a movie about math. Pi. I didn't mention these two last week. Rain Man has plenty of math in it. Moneyball has plenty of math in it. Two of my favorite movies, period. What's your favorite movie about mathematics?
There are not that many movies about math or mathematicians. For something that has an immeasurable influence on our lives, we really are not that interested in it. And even if you say a movie like Beautiful Mind is about math, it's really way more about mental illness. Hidden Figures is about math, but it's really about racism. So I picked Moneyball, a sports movie that isn't really about sports. It's actually about math. And the real hero in that movie isn't an athlete. It's the rational, analytical thinking that overcame emotional decision making. It's like the truest math movie of any of the movies that we just listed.
All right, fair. I haven't seen Pi in a long time, but I think it's probably a good candidate for this,
fair,
too, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't really remember Pi all that well. I didn't love it, so I've never gone back to revisit it.
Well, my favorite of all these, and that's my question, is Good Will Hunting. I've watched that movie plenty of times. I've seen Rain Man plenty of times, and Moneyball for that matter. But Good Will Hunting is the most rewatchable movie of all these ones. Hidden Figures is quite good. I've seen it, I think, only twice, but I'll watch it again one of these days. When you first saw it, and you saw it before I did in 2016, or probably early 2017, you said something like you thought you would not like this movie, you'd even hate it. And you've now seen it twice. I know you're a fan of it.
Three times.
Okay. Yeah. And you're still won over by it. We'll get to those thoughts in a second, but let's set it up here. Black Women Save White Men's Behinds, Butts, was released by 20th Century Fox 5 years ago on Christmas Day, 2016. The $25 million picture made a killing, grossing nearly 10 times its budget. So what an investment for Fox with this movie. And of course, it is now on Disney Plus because they bought Fox's catalog. And it's one of the few movies I can think of as a Fox movie that seems to be on there. I guess Home Alone, those ones are there too. But none of their R-rated stuff like we've talked about before. There's no Die Hard on there, for example. All right, well, please remind us, Bev, what the movie's about with the hidden figures. Skinny.
Katherine Johnson, Dorothy Vaughn, and Mary Jackson are NASA computers in the early 60s during the height of the space race. They work in the colored wing, but each get opportunities to work with their white colleagues where they shine and prove their value to the mission to put an American man in space, particularly Katherine, whose exceptional and rare mathematical talent solves the problem that has been holding back the program, making her a legend despite the institutional racism that held her back.
Or, in a nutshell, I thought there was a lot of peeing in a Tom Hanks movie. I gotta go.
There was like a whole song written for this movie just about her bathroom breaks by Pharrell Williams.
One of the more famous parts of this movie is definitely the montage, or series of them, I guess, when she has to trundle off to the washroom with those notebooks and pencils and pens to continue doing her job. Okay, well, here's some nice numbers on Hidden Figures. The Rotten Tomatoes critics and audiences have the exact same number. 93% of them are in favor. 293 fresh, only 22 rotten from the critics for an average of 7.6 out of 10. And it was 14th at the 2016 U.S. box office. Rogue One was number one. Moonlight, which we covered a couple years ago, and it won Best Picture that year, the controversial La La Land year, was 92nd. That's in our archives way back when. We covered that in 2017. And The Witch, we also covered, I think also 2017, maybe 2018, was 96th. And Hidden Figures had three Oscar nominations, Best Picture, Best Supporting Actress for Octavia Spencer, and the Adapted Screenplay. Taraji P. Henson was not included. Maybe should have been. The whole cast is good, though, and I guess that's what the Best Picture nomination's for, as much as anything, is the entire cast. All right, well, we know you like it. We already said that. Give us your relatively close to opening thoughts on HF.
Well, you kind of spoiled it in that I really expected to hate this movie. I'm usually absolutely allergic to movies like this. It's overly stylized, impossibly pretty, full of swells of inspiring music and clumsy exposition. It's extremely manipulative. Movies like this are usually made to make us all feel a little smug about being on the right side of history. But tarnation, I love this movie. I swear to God, and I am not proud of this admission, when I saw this in theaters, I fought the urge to clap at the end. A behavior I hate and am firmly against. But I was just so cheerfully invested in these three women. I think the credit has to go to the script, the three lead actresses, really, who were so wonderful. And the story itself, which is genuinely inspiring and incredible. And I think it actually avoids a lot of the traps that historical biopics tend to fall into.
The applauding for the movie at the end has always annoyed me too, unless it's a film festival type of thing where the director or the actors, the producers, writers are there. That's different. Well, the director, Theodore Melfi, don't know that name all that well. He did St. Vincent before this. He's written and produced more often than he's directed. He's got quite a few writing and production credits, but not that many directing credits. This is his best movie, I'd say, so far. And he co-wrote with Alison Schroeder. This was her debut. She's worked on Disney stuff since. And they based it on Margot Lee Shetterly's 2016. Yes, the same year the book came out, the movie came out.
Well, the book was a number one New York Times bestseller.
They did have some turnaround there, not many months, but some, because the movie came out in the Christmas time area. But still, that's a pretty fast turnaround, same year. And of course, it's a nonfiction book based on the real stuff. And the woman, by the way, is black, so she knows of where she speaks. And Katherine Johnson, the real person...
By the woman, you mean the one who wrote the book.
Yeah, Margot Lee Shetterly.
Not Katherine Johnson, who was still around then.
Yeah, she only died last February, so February 24th, 2020. She was at the Oscars the year this movie was nominated for those awards. She presented with the three main stars, Henson, Spencer, and Janelle Monáe. I think it was the documentary Oscar. That may have been the year when O.J. Made in America won. But anyway, they presented that award, and she was out there in a wheelchair. So she was in her mid-90s, I guess, or late-90s at that point, and lived three or four more years. By the way, I didn't say already that I like this movie quite a bit, too. I didn't expect not to like it. These kinds of movies do tend to work on me a lot more than they do on you, but it definitely worked on me this time and the first time I saw it as well. I don't think I saw it on the big screen. I think it was only on video or something, or maybe on demand. But it would have been worth seeing on the big screen. Of course, the three stars are the best things in it, but Kevin Costner, another good role for him. I think he does a great job as Al Harrison. Kirsten Dunst is fine, not outstanding. Jim Parsons, I don't know all that well because I never saw The Big Bang Theory. He's quite good too. Mahershala Ali, he's fine, but I don't like the role.
He wasn't a star when he got cast in this part, and he probably never would take it now. He can do much better than this part, which is pretty much just be lovable. Just have chemistry with the star.
Which he does.
Which he absolutely does. He's impossibly perfect as her suitor. all he does is deliver heartwarming moments.
After making a bad first impression by underestimating her, but then apologizing for that the next time he sees her by saying, I underestimated you and I shouldn't have.
And we know that he's interested in her in the first place as soon as he learns what she does for a living through the church announcement. And that's what draws her to him in the first place, which is a nice touch that's appealing to some men. Even today, I think girls probably avoid revealing in romance that they're smart.
Or funny, or talented.
Yeah.
Don't be too good at something if you share that thing.
That's what happens now, so I'm sure it was 100 times worse in the 60s, so that's kind of a nice aspect of their romance. But yeah, I agree. He does a great job at what is just a pretty bland and easy part.
The movie's not that long. It's only a little bit over 2 hours, but I don't really think you need any of the romance in there.
I have the exact same note. Could we just do without Jim Johnson altogether?
We see a little bit of Janelle Monáe's husband, and like any man would be, Aldous Hodge looks like he's way overmatched, way out of his league with Janelle Monáe, but then anyone would, because she, and the same year as this, she did Moonlight, where maybe even more so, is so remarkably beautiful. She's certainly on my short list now for the best looking women I've ever seen on a movie screen. What a flawless beauty. And also, pretty good actress. She's only made 10 movies so far. We saw Antebellum recently. There's potential in that story, but what makes it work as well as it does, because it's not really a thumb-up movie, but it's sort of on the fringe of that.
It grew on me. I didn't like it at first, but it won me over by the end.
But her performance makes it as good as it even is. So here's this singer, and an icon in that world, who's gone to acting fairly recently and has been good in a lot of things. I really liked her in Moonlight the last time we saw it, I guess when we did it for the podcast. And she, of course, is Mahershala Ali's girlfriend in that movie. So the same year, they're both in two quote-unquote black movies. And they both get nominated for the Best Picture Oscar. And one of them does win after that snafu with the envelopes. I don't think this was likely to win, but I'm not that surprised it got nominated because of the feel-good aspect. Based on a real story. Very well done. This cast, Kevin Costner, has only been at the Oscars a few times in his life. And it was early on in his career when he won for Dances with Wolves. But we've talked about how we're Costner apologists. Chris and I have covered him 4 times in our podcast and scoring so at the movies. Funny. Smaller role in Molly's Game, where he's Molly's father. And then he's the GM in Draft Day, so no athletics for him at all on that. But still, 4 times he's been on that podcast. We haven't covered him, you and I, all that often. Dances with Wolves for the Top 100 Project. And of course, we did Bull Durham, one of my favorite roles for any actor, one of my favorite movies.
We'll have to do Waterworld this year.
No. But around this time, he was doing black issue kinds of films. I think McFarland, some movie about runners, was that. But I know that Black or White, which came out a couple years before this, was definitely a race movie. So he's
with Octavia Spencer.
Oh, okay. There you go. So he knew her pretty well. I don't think he ever actually has. If he has any, it's very little screen time with her. No, he does meet her at least once in this movie, doesn't he? They have one scene together in the IBM room.
Right. Yeah.
He also spoke at Whitney Houston's funeral. So to get invited to do that, she must have liked him and he must have meant something to her and her fans, family, all that.
So he is the quintessential white savior. Dances with Wolves, one of the number one movies that people bring up when they're trying to describe the trope of white saviors. He was accused of being a white savior in this film. I disagree with that and I have thoughts. What about you?
When it's based on reality, it's harder to criticize that because there really was a white guy in charge of all the people in that room, most of which were men. In this movie, there's only one other woman that we see that I remember. It's Kimberly Quinn, who is, I guess, in a way, his assistant.
She's the like the office manager.
And that's Melfi's wife. She's been in other things that he's done. I don't remember her from much of anything else other than the Melfi films like St. Vincent. So it's almost entirely white men, dorky-looking math-type people. So you've got to go by the logic of that's what it would have been, and Costner took the role. So it's not him saying, I'm going to be a white savior in this, or that someone else said he should be that. If it was a made-up story, that might be more true to say.
Well, I think people would see the scene where he's knocking down the colored washroom sign. It would certainly trigger lots of memories of white savior movies where they're very much centralized, the white experience.
But a black person can't do that. A white guy is the one who has to do that.
Well, here's my take. To me, a white savior narrative takes an injustice in history and focuses the story on the white character witnessing the injustice rather than the marginalized people experiencing the injustice. And that's not remotely the case here. Harrison is a character in the women's story. He's just a guy who eliminates segregation because it is an inconvenience to him. He really doesn't go out of his way to help Catherine. He just gets out of her way when she gets in his face about it. He doesn't indulge in petty racism the way that the Paul character does, Jim Parsons' character. But it's not really in the service of justice. It's in the service of NASA. So I reject the accusation that his character is a white savior, mostly because he's not the main character of the movie, not even close.
He's the star of that scene, and that is a good scene. That's the typical Hollywood kind of stand-up-and-cheer type of moment. So it's symbolic, but it's a good symbol, too. If you're going to be symbolic, then make it a good symbol.
And I also think that moment was earned by Catherine. And I think the movie is clear that these women fought hard for what they had, and they broke the system down. Rather than the system heroically raising them up, it was a matter of fighting tooth and nail to climb that ladder, literally and figuratively. As in Catherine's case, she puts up with the bathroom situation for a long time until she finally loses her temper for a number of reasons. His reaction is more rational than emotional when you actually see the whole movie and not just the trailer, because that moment's in the trailer, and I feel like that's how a lot of people came to that conclusion.
So they're experts on the movie when they saw 3 minutes of it.
Well, it's a moment that sticks out in your memory because you would have seen it in the trailer, and of course it's a pretty big moment in the film. It's like one of those ridiculous docudrama things. Oh yeah, sure, he just made everybody leave their departments, follow him to watch him take down this sign. People who work in the white wing are not going to have any awareness that the bathrooms have changed because he took down a sign a mile away. But it makes good cinema.
There's a note in the goof section about how he's knocking down the colored sign there, and it had to be, of course, like you said, mile away or half mile away, whatever that is. But that's not the problem. It's the, if it even says whites only, probably says that, whites only bathroom, you should be knocking down that sign. But I guess it's, like I said, symbolic. So you knock down that one. And he says his parting shot in that scene is, at NASA, we all pee the same color. So the obvious implication is you go, and he even says that too, you go wherever you want to. Any of you go wherever you want to. But you're right, the reason that scene works maybe as well as it does, because I think Costner's good in that moment, where he's also a bit out of breath. He's not really playing quite the nerdy, probably paunchy guy that Al Harrison, I'm assuming, was. Older than Costner looks, he still looks pretty damn good, whatever age he is in this movie. But the reason why that scene works even better is because of Henson's freakout, but justified freakout. He won't even drink from the same coffee pot as me, and then it says colored on it, which of course he does rip off before he does the sign thing. I was reading racism at NASA wasn't really an issue because they were too focused on their work, and I thought, NASA's not special that way. There are probably some jobs where people don't lean racist the way they do in some other parts of the world.
Sounds like
other
exactly
jobs.
What somebody who just doesn't really think that hard about racism because they don't have to.
It's also
would
easy
say.
Not to be racist when until this movie's taking place in 1961 and into 1962, you barely ever worked with the black people. You would have seen them at NASA walking the grounds, doing their own job, going into their own section. But you didn't have to be face to face with people that look different from you. And most of the time, you'd have to deal with women. So it's easy to say, I'm not racist, because you're not ever having to deal with them. And when you do, they don't do anything overt. Even Paul, I don't think, is that bad. Or Ruth, who is Kimberly Quinn. I don't think they're that bad. They're the hardest on Catherine in that room. And Al is more about, let's get the job done, put your ego aside, the best person for the job, that kind of thing. So you're right. He's not actually making a huge change in the way things are done, writing a memo to his bosses. But that's how things will change when it comes to racism, sexism, anything like that. It's not going to be somebody with emotion, somebody on Twitter who thinks they have all the power or acts like they do, even if they do have millions of followers. It's going to be some bureaucrat, and most likely, maybe not as much now in 2021, a man who's going to change these things. It isn't going to be the activists because they don't have the power. They don't like it, and that's fine. I don't like it either. They don't have more power. But it's going to be someone who looks like Al Harrison or even Kevin Costner that changes these rules for whatever reason, because they think it's the right thing to do. Or because they actually really don't care about that. They just want the damn job to get done.
And like Harrison, there's always going to be people in the 60s and now who really run the gamut of the spectrum of racist to enlightened. I get the impression Harrison didn't really care, didn't really think about it. But until it was right in his face, inertia allowed him to just leave the system the way it was. And that's how institutional racism works. I hate the trope where there's a foaming at the mouth racist character. Mm-hmm. Green Book, we did a podcast about it, and I was so annoyed by the racist cops in the South. They were not complex characters. They were just straight mustache twisting, racist, hate you. It's not helpful because it's not realistic.
Like, Black Klansman does that too.
Yes, yes, it totally does.
Black Klansman could have been a great movie. We didn't love it for that reason alone, because the white people, I'm not saying that people can't be foaming at the mouth, but when they're all doing that all the time and that's the only dialogue they ever have is about how much we hate black people, I don't think that they're that obsessed every minute of their day. That's the biggest problem we have with Black Klansmen.
Yeah. And there are individuals in this movie who are racist. I think Paul Stafford is racist. And Vivian Mitchell, who's Kirsten Dunst's character, they're racist, but it's subtle, yet unmistakable. Paul is smart. He's used to calling the shots. When Catherine joins the team, his reticence feels like mild bullying. He's behaving like he's put out that he has to even humor this ridiculous ask. And then when she starts to demonstrate her talent, he's acting threatened. I actually really love his performance. I think there's a subtlety to it that really way better demonstrates real-life racism. That is how it presents itself. Not as somebody yelling the N-word at someone, but as somebody just giving too much work to somebody and making their job impossible and sabotaging them because their ego is threatened or there's just something that they can't put their finger on that makes them uncomfortable. And then Vivian is a great character on the other side of the passive-aggressive white woman. She's a total Karen, right?
Yeah.
You just know she's exactly the kind of person that would call the police on a black guy in her neighborhood. And I really believe that Vivian, especially, doesn't recognize the small ways that she disrespects Dorothy or her dismissive tone by using her first name, asking her to transport loads of boxes back with her to her wing. It's so subtle, but it's unmistakable and authentic. There's, of course, that great cathartic moment when Dorothy confronts her. I believe that you believe that you're not racist. It's refreshing to see an oblivious racist be accurately portrayed. And I just agree with you. I think Kirsten Dunst's performance is great because she's actually playing a character who's so detestable. I think it's kind of brave for, especially an actress like her, who for much of her career was kind of an ingenue, played pretty lovable characters.
Or played something really dark like Melancholia.
She's been very brave in her career and she clearly does not care about what people think of her. She's a gutsy actress in that way. And I think this is a gutsy performance for her to play it so realistically. Everybody knows a woman like Vivian.
Or a man like Paul.
Or a man like Paul, yeah.
Kirsten Dunst, we've covered her so much the last couple of years. Spider-Man 2 was a couple of years ago. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind was quite a long time ago, but one of my favorite movies ever. Melancholy, I just mentioned. Little Women, Interview with the Vampire. Chris and I covered Bring It On. So on the two podcast channels I have, there's a lot of Kirsten Dunst movies. And look at the variety of all those roles. Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe she's better than I thought she was in this movie. Not that I think she was bad. The touch I didn't remember, because I haven't seen Hidden Figures in a couple of years, was I thought I was going to be, call me Vivian, rather than Mrs. Mitchell. But instead, at the end, it's Mrs. Vaughn. So she's paying the respect to Dorothy by calling her Mrs. rather than you can call me by my first name. I think Paul and Vivian, but maybe more so Paul, I'm not excusing the racism. Like you say, it's subtle, and that is more effective in a movie, and that's better than what we see in things like Black Klansman, Green Book.
Anybody can watch Black Klansman and think to themselves, well, I'm nothing like those monsters.
So I can't be racist.
So I can't be, yeah. If that's what a racist is, well, I'm definitely not that. But I think they would watch Hidden Figures and maybe see themselves a little bit.
That's fair. But I think what Paul is threatened by is three things. We're agreeing that he probably is racist because most people in the 60s, so many people now, were and are. The second thing is he's threatened by her being a woman. The whole thing about breaking protocol by letting her go into top secret meetings.
There's no protocol for a woman to go to a meeting. What do you think women do?
We have to zip our flies up. Normally we go into these meetings pantsless. And the third reason, the biggest reason I think of all, though, is that he realizes relatively soon after meeting her that she's really talented, and he feels like his job is threatened or his ego is threatened or his whatever is threatened. And that's paid off at the end. Again, not subtle, but done well. When she's at her desk, Al is in his office doing whatever he's doing, working late like always, and Paul brings Catherine a coffee and quietly sets it down for her as if this has become our new routine. He hasn't necessarily been humbled in some big scene where Al Harrison or anyone else or Catherine herself had to say, you treat me with respect. It's just he's finally giving it to her. So it doesn't excuse his previous behavior, but it's him learning that while she's an important part of the team, maybe Harrison basically said, she is now truly in this spot, because she was actually demoted after she helped them figure out how they're going to get John Glenn back to space with the go-no-go thing they keep talking about. So she figured that out, and then she was demoted, and Al didn't want to do it. He says hands were tied. I believe him. Maybe he could have fought harder before than he did, but we don't see the scene where that was announced. But then she's brought back in because they desperately need her. And John Glenn, in reality, did want her to confirm the numbers, the calculations, but just not right before the launch, where he's literally in his spacesuit. Okay, I'm on the phone right here. If this is no good, I guess I'll take this off and go back home. It was days before. Just like the whole bathroom thing apparently was more Mary's issue. And if Mary, in reality, was the way that Janelle Monáe is in this movie, that actually makes some sense because Janelle Monáe, in most roles she's had, has a great sass. I love it. Certainly it's an antebellum before. Well, that's a twist movie. Maybe I shouldn't say what happens in that movie. But she's got a lot of sass and a big mouth, and I mean that as a compliment. But apparently the real Mary Jackson just ignored the sign and walked into the white restroom anyway and just went ahead and did her business. And maybe some people were aghast and maybe some didn't care. But they were women too, so they probably didn't bother saying anything to anybody. So it wasn't this whole dramatic thing of running across the campus from a different character is what I was reading. And it wasn't Catherine's issue at all, but it works for this. And also, Catherine is the most meek of the three of them and the least bossy. And I don't mean that's a bad, I know that's a bad thing for women to hear, but I don't think it's a bad word. I think all three of these people should be in charge of people and should be bosses of people. And Dorothy, by the end of the movie, gets to be that.
Yeah, she's the most introverted of the group and would just love to put her head down and work. And you talk about Paul being humble. She just starts humble. When I went to college, the college I went to was built in the 60s. I was in the film program, so I was in the technical wing of the college. There was no ladies' room.
Really?
Yep. They just did not build a women's washroom in our wing of the college, and it had never been upgraded, so we had to walk to the main section of the campus, which wasn't that far, but it was still far enough to be annoying that your washroom break was an extra 5 minutes compared to the guys that I was in school with. And just the slap in the face, too, that you don't really belong here. Although I could only take it so personally, our class was 50% women.
Odd, too, that it's saying that you never had guests.
And that was in the 60s that they built that. So we were talking about how Catherine is humble. Another thing that I think sets this movie apart from a lot of movies like it, and there's no shortage of movies about geniuses, about historical geniuses. The last 20 years has been rife with movies and TV shows about Sherlock Holmes or House or The Imitation Game, Beautiful Mind. They all have one thing in common, and that is that the genius in question knows they're the smartest guy in the room and has the ego to match his intelligence. Often they're jerks. They are condescending and impatient with all the normies that they have to deal with. And I think that people take a peripheral joy from somebody just schooling all the idiots in the world, and maybe there's a pleasure in that, but it's really snarky and negative. One of my main problems with Imitation Game and Hidden Figures is so refreshing in the way that it never leans on that trope. Even once prejudices are no longer a factor, the women are always just trying to put their heads down and do the work. They don't need to belittle their colleagues, even if they are smarter than them, and when they finally have favor shown upon them for one reason or another, they use their newfound power and influence to lift up everybody else and really be a part of that team.
Well, I said Dorothy is a boss now. It looks like she's got a lot of people underneath her. And I'm guessing it's a coalition of all kinds of different people. Certainly women, because she wanted her girls to go with her in the first place. But it's the white guys who couldn't quite program that machine. They're probably brilliant too, but they're just not as brilliant as she is.
Yeah, she's just better, and she has to work harder. We know it, and we see it when she goes to the library and she steals that book. And I have worked with people. You see them on Monday. What'd you do this weekend? Oh, well, I went on the Avid forums, and I learned about all these new tricks you can do on editing. And I'm like, really? I would never do that. I will learn those new tricks on the day that I absolutely have to, and not 1 second sooner. But kudos to you.
And Mary goes back to school. I don't know how old she's supposed to be. Probably at least 30. She's got two kids. There's one of the fantasies of this movie. That a woman with that body had anybody come out of it. Although sometimes women do drop the weight. You never know they ever had a kid. One of the coworkers of mine, I've known her for a long time, has three kids. And when she came back from each one of the pregnancies, you would think that she went on vacation and didn't have a kid because she looked exactly the same she always did with no waist at all. Some people are just blessed that way. But anyway, Mary has to go back to school. And she charms the judge by appealing to his ego.
She does the same with the cop. She just knows what to say to these white men to get her way. And she works within the system to make it work for her. It probably doesn't hurt that she's beautiful. I don't know how beautiful the real Mary Jackson was. The only pictures I saw of her.
At the end.
Yeah, when she was older.
No one's as beautiful as Janelle Monáe.
No one's as beautiful as Janelle Monáe. I don't think anybody could say no to her for any reason. But I love her speech. Like, it's so smart because it seems like this really inspiring speech. But if you were to take it apart, I'm talking about her in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. It's just her buttering him up.
Yeah.
Don't you want to be the guy who was the first person to let a woman into the school? Wouldn't that make you amazing?
I'll say what Chris and I have talked about in some of our podcasts. Of course, it's always about sports, and that's something that women are still having a hard time really breaking into. You're finally seeing coaches, not quite managers. So baseball, what you call a coach in other sports, they called a manager, but it's the same job. No one that I'm aware of in the big sports, except the women's sports, like women's basketball, for example, have ever had a woman do that job, but they're getting to be GMs or assistant GMs now. That's finally happening now. And Chris and I were just talking about this on The Fan last month. Ellen Barkin's a sports commentator. You know then, and you certainly know now, that if she dared or any woman like her dare to have a job like that and have an opinion, she would get bashed by so many guys simply because it's Ellen Barkin, not Jim Barkin. And that's stupid for a lot of reasons, but one of the ones is that there could come a time in 25 or 50 years where the greatest person who ever did blank job could very well be a woman or somebody who doesn't identify with either sex. And I'm not going to be surprised if that does happen. This whole notion that they can't do it is dumb. Look at Katherine Johnson. Here's what happens next, we always do. Well, it's hard to do that with a real movie. We know what happened in her life. There's a building name for her at NASA. When you Google NASA on Google Maps, you can see the Katherine G. Johnson whatever building. It says that right there. It's not that far from where the main NASA building is, I guess. It's probably walking distance away. She got the Medal of Freedom when Obama was in office, too. But here's what happens next in the fantasy world. Maybe she gets to fly to the moon or go to space. Or at least maybe this did happen in reality. Get to be in the control room and not have to be pity let in by, not even really pity. Al knows she belongs in there. She's had the door literally closed in her face. A few seconds go by, she starts to walk away. But then it opens up. He's got a badge for her, whatever you call that thing to wear.
There's
in your
no
neck.
Protocol, though.
But that's the control room, though, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And then she's let in and she's around for the drama in this movie. Again, I guess based on reality, that they were worried that the heat shield wouldn't hold and he would die, which is what the end of Apollo 13 is. This movie shares that ending. He was supposed to make 7 flights around the Earth in the course of something like 10 to 11 hours. Instead, he made only 3 of them. But still, the fact he got up there at all and came back safely was the mission. And she helped make that happen. And John Glenn has played the way I've seen him be played by other people. Ed Harris in The Right Stuff. And I feel like I've seen a John Glenn portrayal in some other movie where he is this nerdy, really nice guy. You'd like to know him, but he'd be a little bit dull. And that's fine. He's also a NASA guy. They're probably all a little bit dull. They probably can't be too wild and crazy if they're going to have a job like that. And Glenn Powell plays him just fine. Solid performance. This is the rare movie about space travel, though, that barely shows us astronauts. We only really see the astronauts about midway through the movie, and then it's mostly Glenn that's involved or has any dialogue. We really don't get any dialogue or time with the other guys who were famous from that era, like Gus Grissom or Alan Shepard, or, of course, the Apollo astronauts, including Jim Lovell and so on, who probably were around at that. They must have been around at that point in the early 60s. One touch I'm sure is deliberate by the writers and Melfi and everybody, and maybe it's in the book, too, is the Americans are worried about the Russians putting bombs in space. They got their first, of course, with Sputnik. And they're worried about that because they know that's what they would do. They're the ones that dropped nukes on people not that long before in Japan to end a war. So why are they so paranoid? Because they want to do the same thing. And of course, Star Wars, not even 20 years later, around 20 years later, was Reagan's pet project. And now Trump has brought it back, although hopefully Biden will say, we have other things to worry about. We already have enough nukes on the ground. None of the people we see portrayed are bad people. They're doing their country's bidding. They're doing their job. They're thinking about the defense of their country. But it also comes across to me like a bit of a hypocrisy that, how dare they do this stuff? They just beat you to it. What are you saying? How dare they?
Yeah, they just were better than you. Maybe the reason that Russia beat America to space is because they notoriously don't hold their women back in the same way. They don't have a gendered or racial underclass, so they were pulling their talent from most people in Russia. I'm sure that there is an underclass in Russia, but when you look at NASA, all white men, well, that's what, 35% of Americans are white men, which means there's 65% of Americans whose talent you're not taking advantage of. Russia wasn't doing that, so that could be one of the reasons why they beat them to space. They never would have held back their Katherine Johnson.
Don't you want to have the best team possible? But I guess they're worried about their jobs. That's probably part of Paul's problem. So I'd like to think more people would not have to constantly be talking about race on Twitter and in reality all the time, but just when it comes up, would you work with that person? You want to be with that person? Would you want that person on your team who doesn't look like you and doesn't share your sex? Yes, if they're good, especially. Bring more. Mm-hmm. Flood my team with these kinds of people who are this good at this thing and who want to do it and who can make it better.
And I think research shows, actually I'm pretty sure research shows, that the more diverse a team is, the better they perform.
Well, as far as performing goes, the three women are really good together. They don't have that much screen time after the early scene where we see them trying to fix the car and then the cop comes along. And I think that cop plays that scene pretty well, like you said. First of all, he's not that bad, but he's not a very nice guy. Then he finds out what they're doing, and he respects that. So, let's hustle you off to work. And, of course, Mary's driving 900 miles an hour.
Right up his butt, too. Kissing his bumper.
The other two should be terrified. So they have the barbecue scene, and they have a dinner at one point. But most of the movie, they're not on screen together. They don't work together after the early days when they would have. When the movie's starting, they work in that same room with the other black women.
They have a lot of little scenes where they touch. It's a ride home, or when they're drinking moonshine in the afternoon, or Catherine's wedding. They have these quick little scenes where they reconvene throughout the film.
But my point is they don't really have that much solid screen time together at work because they wouldn't. That's not their job to be together at work. But I'd love to see a movie with these three really truly having a lot of screen time together.
They have so much chemistry. And yet another way that I feel like this film kind of stands out from a lot of, quote, issues films, partially because of their relationship, it is really packed with humor and love and joy. They take so many breaths in the film to joke around with one another or sound off or dance in the kitchen. There's a real connection with them and their community, which is very present in the film. And they just seem like happy people. They aren't driven by some trauma or by dissatisfaction in their lives or anger about their circumstances. It is refreshing that a film about race illustrates these large parts of their world where race is irrelevant. Catherine doesn't have to think about being black when she's falling in love with Jim, and neither do we. Their lives don't revolve around civil rights, and they're allowed to care about the space race as much as they care about advancements in their lives and their community, and to care about the space race as much as their white colleagues and friends and neighbors.
Definitely. That whole thing at the end when Al says to her, what's the line, something like, what do you want to do next? Get to the moon, sir. I'm already there. She's as obsessed with the job as he is. She has a family. I guess he does too, but we don't really ever meet anybody in his life other than the people he works with. Koster pretty much spends the whole movie in that office and then other parts of NASA. Well, Taraji P. Henson, the first time I ever saw her was Hustle and Flow, where I thought she was great, and then she ended up working with her pimp in that movie, Terrence Howard in Empire on television. I never saw that show, but people rave about it, so I'm going to guess it's pretty good.
And rave about her in it, too, especially.
Oh, yeah, right. And then she was also nominated for a Supporting Actress Oscar for The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. She's had a pretty solid career.
Isn't Mahershala Ali in Curious Case of Benjamin Button as well?
He might be, back when he was Mahershala Al-Shabazz.
Is that right?
Yeah, Mahershala Al-Shabazz, one full long name. You're right, he's in The Curious Case of Benjamin Button. He's Tizzy, and it's Mahershala Al-Shabazz.
Oh my gosh, it's all one word until Ali.
He was in a lot of movies that you didn't really realize who he was. He was in Predators, two of the Hunger Games movies, and then Moonlights, where he finally had the big breakout.
I remember him from House of Cards. That's where I first saw him.
Right, the TV show, yeah, with Kevin Spacey. Octavia Spencer, of course, The Shape of Water. We covered that because it won the Best Picture Oscar the year after Moonlight won this year's Oscar for Best Picture, 2016. We didn't love that movie very much. She was nominated for that as well. And then she won the Oscar for The Help in that same category years before. And we just talked about her only about a month ago on Fruitvale Station, where we thought she was as good in that as she's ever been in anything. To me, this would probably be second, although I did like her in The Help. She's one of the best things in The Help, without a doubt.
I don't think she has a ton of range. I think she's an actress who's always, to some extent, playing Octavia Spencer. But Octavia Spencer is just so charming and lovable. I'm for more Octavia Spencer in movies.
You haven't seen that movie Ma, where she plays
a villain? I haven't.
Challenger.
Yeah, really meant to.
I bet she could do a lot more than you think if they challenged
her. Oh, okay. She's got screen presence to spare. She is one of those actresses that absolutely pops. And not because she's pretty, and not to say that she's ugly, but she's definitely not Hollywood pretty. That's just how much charisma she has.
Same goes for Henson and Monet, although Monet has the looks. We talked about that already. Mahershala Ali, I just realized this, looking this up, he's 2 days younger than me. He was born on February 16th. 1974, so his birthday is going to be pretty soon, but 2 days literally younger than me. Also, Elizabeth Banks. I looked her up because Chris and I are doing, let me see my timeline here, later this week, we're doing Invincible. She's in that with Mark Wahlberg, and she is, I think it's 4 days older than me. So again, almost exactly the same age as me.
And you're all about to turn 40.
47. Ariana Neal plays one of Catherine's daughters. And she was Oscar Grant's daughter in Fruitvale Station, so Octavia Spencer was around her a lot for a few years there. When Jim is proposing and they keep contributing, I know it's supposed to be cute, but I literally said to you, just shut up and let him do it. This isn't your wedding. It's not the kid's fault, but that was bad. That was irritating.
They also have one of the most embarrassing exposition scenes in the movie when we first meet them and they're in bed, staying awake, waiting for their mom to come home. And she's talking to them about doing her job and explaining it to the audience, too, as if these kids don't know. And then one of them just almost randomly says something like, Daddy's in heaven. What a weird thing to say. But okay, it's all for our benefit. They are the classic Hollywood movie kids. Why are you never taking care of these children? Even when they're at church on Sunday, they pretty much disappear when it's convenient and they just want to set her up with Jim. She's never with her children. It's like sitcom kids. Where are they?
Or Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Oh, that is the worst offender there is.
Maybe ever in any kind of pop culture.
Those kids are being raised by wolves.
It's one of the reasons we got sick of that show. It was so dumb that way. I know it's a dumb thing to get obsessed about, but anyway. So we mentioned Theodore Amalfi wrote and directed and also produced. So he was nominated for two Oscars that night, but not as a director. Peter Chernin, Donna Gigliotti, I think is how you say her name. I think I said it wrong on Shakespeare in Love many years ago. Jenno Topping, who is a woman, and Pharrell Williams. So except for Chernin and Melfi himself, but three of the other five people are not white men. Pharrell Williams, who's only done six scores, including for this movie, was nominated for a producing Oscar. It's way more common, as we've said, in the last 20 or 30 years for women to get nominated. They often do. More often than not, it seems like a woman's a producer, if not the only producer, on a Best Picture nominee, two in this case. But black people of any type, not so common, but Pharrell Williams was in this category. I assume you thought Melfi's direction was pretty solid and fine.
Yeah, like I keep repeating, this movie is very much not my taste, but it worked on me. The movie must be well made for me to be this emotionally attached, despite the fact that it's a movie I should normally hate.
So it's 2-3-9-1. We watched it on Disney Plus. The cinematographer Mandy Walker did Shattered Glass and last year's Mulan, which I don't know if anyone really saw. That's on Disney Plus also, if you want to see it. And she is one of the not so rare anymore, but still relatively rare woman cinematographers. I had to double check that, thinking, oh, it could be a guy with the name Mandy, I guess, but it is a woman, according to her IMDb picture. The editor, Peter Teschner, cut Borat way back when, and also did Scoring at the Movies episodes that Chris and I did, Dodgeball and Semi-Pro, so mostly comedy-type stuff. I don't know if it's really comedy in this movie, but it has a light tone at times. But I just said Pharrell Williams did the music along with Benjamin Welfish, who did the It movies, meaning both of Pennywise It horror films compared to this. Although this isn't a comedy, I guess, so it's not that different. It's a drama, this is. And then Hans Zimmer also had a music credit on this, because that guy never stops working.
He keeps saying it's a drama, but it has a bit of a comedy spirit. There's lots of laughs in it, and it has that kind of stone-skipping pace, very light.
Yeah, for a movie that's over 2 hours, it doesn't feel that slow. But what'd you think of the look and the cutting, the music, the production design, all that?
I love the technicals. I think everybody got it right. It does another thing I hate in historical biopics, which is the production design is kind of ridiculous and that everything looks absolutely brand new. Like, there's not a shirt in this movie full of scientists who work around the clock, yet all their shirts are crisp, white, ironed. They look like they're fresh out of the box. And these women, who we know don't have a lot of money, the car is broken down, but it looks perfect. The paint job is sparkling, shiny, perfect. Their clothes are always immaculate and look brand new and perfectly tailored. But I don't think they're going for realism. I think it's Hollywood. We're going to make it pretty. We're going to make Janelle Monáe have these popping red lips, even if it's ridiculous. But it's fun to look at. These are the choices that they made in the film. I think they did an excellent job.
I said to you during it as well, and this is real, of course, because they would have had to wear high heels when they're women, and the guys had to wear ties all the time. This is the 60s that this movie's set in, so okay, fine. But why? And maybe we won't anymore after COVID and everyone talking about wanting to wear their jammy bottoms all the time, even in real life, regular life. But why did we ever put a thing around our neck and make it so that you can't really breathe properly? And women with those heels, how and why do they ever put up with that?
I've had to wear a tie and I've had to wear heels, and I will pick a tie. I would wear five ties at once before I would wear heels all day at work.
Thank I can't
God
relate
I've
to
never
that.
Really had to.
I can't relate to that, but I can believe that completely.
They're torture devices. I can't believe women do it as much as they do.
Especially the ones that have the really tall heel as well, which generally they seem to have in this movie. There's a scene where Janelle Monáe gets caught and maybe could have died if she hadn't left her shoe behind, and eventually does leave her shoe behind. Because they're doing a test where she might be badly hurt. But why is she wearing heels? She obviously has to. But just the reality of that, why do we do that to ourselves as human beings? Especially in a job where it's not really about how you look. There are jobs where that really fits, I guess. But this, when they get into the NASA headquarters, look at Al Harrison. He's dressed like he's supposed to. He's got a three-piece suit on, actually. Well, he tends to take the jacket off, but he's got the vest. Yeah. If I had to wear a suit, I would be a three-piece suit guy. It might be tough in the summer. Luckily, in my job, I've never had a dress code.
I'll never remember the name of it now, but there was a great documentary about the Large Hadron Collider and the team that put it together. And I'll just say, those nerdy scientists have given up on any pretense of looking like even human beings. They were the most ratty-looking bunch. Delightful. There's so many charmers and so much passion in that movie. It's actually really lovely. But scientists, in reality, I think, could care less about the way that they dress.
The astronauts, that's a different story. We've seen it in a lot of astronaut-type movies where part of it is the PR. You've got to try to look good for the audience. You've always got to be smiling. And those guys had to be level-headed enough. They probably weren't boiling cauldrons of hate underneath that they had to hide. They probably were relatively happy people. I think they got paid pretty well, too. The women in this movie, not so much. But that's a little different. They're the front people. These people that are not really ever in front of cameras. Al is. He has to do press conferences and that kind of stuff and talk to Congress, I think, at one point. But then, of course, you dress up for that. Anyway, long tangent, but just made me think, why did we ever do this? Not just why do we do it now, why do we do it in old movies like this? We're dumb. All right, well, the last thoughts on our first movie of February would normally be Oscar month, which this could have fit because it was nominated for 3, and it was worthy, I think, of those nominations. But anyway, no Oscars until April, if even then. So we're doing a Black History movie in Black History Month, and a very important topic that I don't know that a lot of people knew about. I didn't.
So, yeah, I guess this movie proves that no one can ever be absolutist about one's taste, because I hate everything about this movie except for the fact that I love the movie. It just wins me over every time.
Well, it does risk getting sappy, and I could have done without the love story. The two actors are good together, but that's not the point. The women are great together, but like I said, don't have as much screen time as I might have liked, except they're not going to when they're on the job. So, oh, that's minor quibbles. It's a really solid, and maybe even better than solid, movie. We never know what the Oscar tally was from a year. We're never going to find out. But the whole La La Land snafu, we've seen that a second time. We didn't even like it that much the second time. So for it to be second, if it was, and it probably was, seems nuts. I'm not sure this is my second favorite movie of those nominees from 2016, but it's better than La La Land. Moonlight's better than this, but it's fairly close. And there's such different movies with two of the same actors in it. The delightful Monet, the fierce delightful Monet, and of course the supremely talented Mahershala Ali. All right, in 7 days it will be February 8th, and that's getting as close as we will to Valentine's Day without going over. So we will choose to review the epitome of cartoon romance, the now 30-year-old Disney classic, 30 years old, Beauty and the Beast. Talk about plaudits. It's going to take a long, big breath to get through those plaudits. I've already started working on the template for that podcast. Wow, so many AFI lists. All right, the coming attractions trivia for La Belle et la Bête. It's the only animated movie to make both the AFI's Top 100 Passions, and the Top 25 Musicals. In fact, there's only one other cartoon that ranked on either of those lists at all, which is the other one, then.
All right, so for the answer to that question, check out next week's podcast about Beauty and the Beast. You can also check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project wherever fine podcasts are sold. All of our episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and or 07 list of the best American films ever made, and hundreds more titles on top of that. Maybe in exchange for all of this first-class content, you could leave us a rating and a review that helps people find us. We are both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis. Ellis Ryan is at MovieFiend51. You can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code TOP100PROJECT, and that's all one word, TOP100PROJECT. It's not case sensitive. That will get you a 20% discount.
I heard there's a spaceship landing somewhere off the coast of Nova Scotia tonight, so let's go outside in our backyard and surely we'll see it from there.
Let's look out the window, and if we can't see it from there, let's go to our nearest hardware store and watch TV through the window.
But in the meantime, it's time for me to knock my Bev's Only sign off the bathroom so we can all pee the same color and get some work done. We all pee the same color here in the Ellis household.
I've been making you pee outside with the dogs.
No more Bev's Only signs.
And cut.